This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. Hundreds of movement leaders, activists, organizers, funders, and journalists gathered in Atlanta, Georgia in June 2023 at A Light, A Line, A Rise, an invitation-only conference on reparations organized by the Decolonizing Wealth Project. As the conference's media partner, Yes Media spoke with more than a dozen prominent organizers, activists, and leaders, among them Richard Wallace, the founder and executive director of Equity and Transformation Chicago. EAT, as it's called, is an organization fighting for social and economic equity for Black workers in informal work and those who have been formerly incarcerated. Wallace is also the board president at Working Family Solidarity. Prior to joining EAT Chicago, he worked with the Workers' Center for Racial Justice and Chicago Workers Collaborative. And here's my conversation with him in Atlanta.
My name is Richard Wallace. I'm the founding executive director of Equity and Transformation, also known as EAT. We're based in Chicago, Illinois.
So being here at this conference on reparations, when you think about reparations, often we think about the state distributing resources in a way that tries to, at least in part, compensate for the harms, not only from slavery, but everything that has come after it. But it is a reliance on the state. And at your panel at this conference, you referred to freeing yourself from the idea of this, of being dependent on the state. And I thought that was a unique take. Can you tell me more about that?
Yeah, I think that take really came through my experience actually traveling to New Zealand and witnessing beneficiaries of reparations from the Crown. And those are the Māori, which are the indigenous people of New Zealand. And while I was there, some explicit, I think, notices were that they had turned away from the state. And they were, you know, self-determination was like at the core of their work. And that drove them to do things like create alternatives and create interventions to save their people because that was their priority. Reparations were secondary to the saving of their people. And so that is what really drove me into thinking creatively about Chicago and what are the interventions that we have in place that are like committed to saving our people. What are the alternatives that are happening on the ground? And so for me, that's an away from, and also it's a joyful experience because it's like, oh, I can do this, or oh, we can do this. And so for me, that's like what excites me most is like this idea of restitution and the possibility that we can have an imprint on what that benchmark actually provides for our people.
Because otherwise you're waiting on Congress to do the right thing. You're waiting on the political winds to fly in the right direction.
Mm-hmm. And if we don't, I mean, I think one of the things, one of the challenges that I've experienced as an organizer historically is that they fund us to dismantle. They don't give us any resources to rebuild. And so what happens is that often what we dismantle is then replaced by the same people who built what we just dismantled, right? And so we see that with, like, I think a lot of the prison abolition work and us fighting to end prisons, and then they're turning and they're increasing house arrests, right? So they're making our communities the new prisons, right? And so, like, and on one hand, it's a win because they shut down this prison, or less people are going to physical prisons. But when they turn the community into one, we're like, oh, that's not what we meant. So if we don't do the front end work of dreaming and actually creating these alternatives with community, we leave that dreaming and that imagination up to, you know, the same people who have ultimately created the systems that we're trying to solve now.
What can self-determination look like? And what can you point to? What are the projects or programs and very concrete examples you can point to that show the way forward for you as a path to just restitution that's actually achievable?
Yeah, I think for me, even on a small scale, I would like to develop a program that firmly commits to reconnecting our people to land, language, and lineage. I want people and Black people in Chicago to understand that their native tongue is Goon or Yoruba or Cree, right? And actually have coursework that is and professors, which we can bring in. We have the resources to bring professors in to teach them their native language and be reconnected to the land. And so that means actually traveling and taking trips to the continent to actually feel the soil, work the land, be with their people. And then also understanding their history does not end or begin in Jackson, right? And although Jackson has it is one of the most important spaces, Arkansas, a lot of the folks that are in Chicago migrated from Arkansas and Jackson, but they believe that their story begins there. And their story actually begins on the continent of Africa. And so for me, it's like that connection is a missing piece that we need to focus on, and that I think that we have the power or the agency to actually create on our own. Right? Like we can do that. Like we can bring professors in to teach our youth goon. We can build trips, right, home, and we can build deeper relationships with the continent. So we have this exchange, right, where I think the articulation of what is Black culture becomes possible, right, through understanding and reconnecting to the land.
And then how does that lead to things like access to, you know, education, wealth, jobs, compensation, you know, being able to pass generational wealth, finding equity?
Yeah, I mean, I think restitution is one pillar, right? It's one that I feel like is not getting enough emphasis, so I'm lifting it up intentionally. Compensation is super important, right? Compensation is so important. The guarantees of non-repetition, so important. But a lot of both guarantees of non-repetition and compensation are state-facing, right? When we're talking about guarantees of non-repetition, we're talking about the state closing the door and shutting the door on the harms related to chattel slavery and ensuring that it'll never happen again. Compensation requires banks and the state, right, to actually give the money back that they stole as it relates to Black labor. The other pillars, like rehabilitation and restitution, are pillars that we can be proactive in. And so for me, I feel like there's more creativity. And for me, in my place, in my position within the world and within the work, what I'm most interested in at this time is exploring rehabilitation and restitution and how we, as people who have been invested in, right, with social capital, et cetera, can give back to the community in ways that address those pillars.
There is a history, right, and especially in the Black community, of self-determination and programs that the Black Panther Party put together that offer models. Are those things that you look to?
Oh, most definitely. And I feel like those in Chicago, what won people to the party was the breakfast program. It's actually providing a viable alternative to the state. And that was very threatening to the state because the state wanted us dependent on the state, not dependent on the people. And that is, I feel like, you know, part of capitalism and the role that capitalism plays is this rugged individualism, right? I. Part of the reparations and restoring ourselves to a community is that it's not I anymore, it's we. And that breakfast, providing breakfast, may be a very simple, and some people are like, we gotta go to the most intellectual, da 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 da. It's like, no, very simple. Provide breakfast. You know, our babies are going to school without, we're living in food deserts. We don't have access to fresh produce, et cetera, create a produce campaign. Provide breakfast, provide a childcare program. Very simple, right? Doesn't take a PhD to figure it out. And I think we overthink the simple. And the simple can be exactly what the people need at that moment.
When you reach out to people through the basic needs like food, is that also then the starting point of a conversation you can have with them about things like reparations?
Yeah, and I think our people have been inundated with campaigns and demands that this is for this. This is, no, sometimes we need to give for the sake of giving and not necessarily for the reward at the end. And I think that through that, right, giving for the sake of giving, doing for the sake of doing, we dismantle some of those ideologies around rugged individualism, around me, and being consistent, right? Because our people have seen pop-up survivability mechanisms, right? You know what I'm saying? Like, we've seen it before. So we're talking about creating a consistent pulse in the community that is actually, direct conflict with the norm. That could be hugging, right? That could be, that can be looking people in the eyes. That can be breakfast. That can be childcare. That can be all the other things that we, our folks necessarily need. That is the opposite of the norm right now. And I think don't think it takes a lot of resources to do those things.
Going back to what you started out saying, in New Zealand, you saw the example of a community, an indigenous community that had been survived colonization, winning what they needed to win by not focusing on the state. Did they get reparations from the state without having to directly lobby the state?
No, I think the lobbying came later, right? I think what was most important to them is saving their people. From my perspective, right? And that in the effort of saving their people, they began to create alternatives. Those alternatives became successful. And so they're defendable as alternatives, right? And so the Crown then adopts these alternatives because they're working. They're no longer, so once they become proven, proof of concept, essentially, they work. But then those people who became aware and reconnected to their land, their language, and their lineage became the force behind the reparations movement. And so for me, it's like, reparations may not be the entry point. It could be breakfast, right? But the end goal is this collective people who are healed. I mean, and also, I forgot to mention on the panel, they focused on healing. It was a campaign for healing. And they considered reconnecting around land, language, and lineage components of the healing process. So this journey towards healing, right? And coming from a city where, you know, I believe like 700 people are murdered that look like me every year. And the perpetrators look just like me, right? Of those violent attacks. And the police target me. I live every day with a certain amount of trauma in my body. So it's impossible for me to think that it's important for them to stand up and stand on a podium and talk about House Bill, HB, whatever, whatever, when they're facing death, right? Or they've experienced harm at home, and we ain't unpacking that for them, right? And so for me, it's like super important to really, you know, I hear a lot of slogans like show up as my whole self, but are you talking to the community like that? Are you asking the community to show up for a campaign, right? And so for me, it's like less about the campaign. The campaign is just this, I think about it as the North Star. The entry point to the campaign can be anything. Right. And we can create that anything. Right. And so there's a lot of possibility in that for me.
Is there something to be said for also a movement needing a diversity of tactics, needing that inside outside strategy, needing the congressman on the inside, congressperson on the inside, the activist on the outside, those who are focused on the House bill, those who are focused on the mutual aid, mm-hmm. and everything in between?
Oh, most definitely. I'm not a person that's opposed to policy. We have pushed forward and passed many policies in the state of Illinois. It was the witnessing our members show up to protest and to direct actions in the midst of suffering trauma around domestic violence and addiction. And we didn't have any resources to address that. And so you got people that are actually experiencing trauma, advocating for policy change, and there's no one who is focusing on them. And so for me, it was like, no, we need to do a little bit of both. I think it's a both and. We can still move policy, which is what we're going to do in Chicago. Shout out to the funders. We're going to move some policy. But at the same time, we're going to move people. And so I think it's the both and the duality of organizing that is super important to kind of like get across in this message. It's like it's the both and. Like, you are doing that work if you are providing childcare. You are doing that work if you're hugging, and you know what I mean? Like, you're doing that work to dismantle, because that is, you know, these are products of capitalism, right? Rugged individualism is a product of that, right? And so for us, the opposite, any activity that's in the opposite of it is actually part of the campaign. You know what I mean? Like, it's part of the policy implementation. It's part of it.
The idea that reparations are needed is very much rooted in collectivism, right? Because capitalism says, if you didn't make it, it's your fault. If you made it, it was entirely because of your own impetus, and if you didn't survival of the fittest, too bad. Whereas reparations is the opposite of that, right?
Indeed, yeah.
There's some talk around, having the corporate system take account, but, change its culture and be held accountable, the state needing to be held accountable, et cetera. But none of these accountabilities happen just on their own or by asking nicely, right? Mm-hmm. You have to force the state, you have to force markets, mm-hmm. you have to make them do the right thing, right?
Yeah. Yeah, you have to have an organized. I mean, democracy essentially means that if a decision is made that impacts your life, you have a right to play a role in how that decision is made. And so for us at EAT, one of the core practices that we have is re-engaging people in democracy. Right? And so people have to understand, if there's a local decision, who is the alderperson? Who's your state rep? How do you engage with them, right? Around what it is that you may need. And you organize that force to register to vote. You know what I mean? If that's what you want to do, if voting is your thing, you go vote. These are different forms of force, right? And different tactics. And so I think yes, we need an organized force to kind of move this needle. But at the same time, our community's got to heal. Because I'm also gonna reflect on a moment in 2020 when the defund piece was surfacing across the city. We pushed and advocated for a bill called HB 3653, along with a number of other folks, which was it accompanied what we call the Illinois Breathe Act. And at the same time, we're seeing extremely high rates of intra-community violence, right? And so the state then turns and looks at the violence in our communities and says, we can't remove police because this is. And so we're door knocking, and the community's like, well, what's the alternative to police? And we need viable answers for that. We need answers for that, right? And not just theory. They need to see organized forces of Black people serving as the alternative to that, right? If you're a victim of or survivor of domestic violence, who are you gonna call? Right. Is there a hotline, a movement hotline that you can call when you're in an emergency? And for me, I'm like, there's so much joy in the idea that we can create those things. Right. And so that's not opposed to divesting from police. That's actually part of the campaign of divesting from police. And so for me, I feel like there's so much joy and excitement around the idea of almost every deficit that exists in our community that we have an opportunity to actually create.
And there are a lot of alternatives that people are exploring in different communities around the country to create those kinds of hotlines you were just mentioning.
Mm-hmm. Co-ops, you got co-ops popping up. You got urban gardens. I remember when the pandemic kicked in, we created produce and protests where we connected with Black farmers who had a surplus of resources because they couldn't sell to the restaurants. And we brought fresh produce to the community, and people had carrots and all this other stuff. And also some folks forgot how to cook it. So we had to make a little cookbook that we got some elders together to create a little cookbook on how to actually cook these greens and these carrots and make the stews. So and it was dope. It was a lot more humanizing work than just begging folks who do not believe in the world that we believe in to believe in it. And so what it was and people began to believe in what we were doing because we did it. You know what I mean? Oh, wait, we can actually bring produce to the hood, right? It's not a genius idea. It was y'all got a surplus. These people have a deficit. Let's move the resources to do this, right? But we need agile philanthropy that allowed us to be nimble and not be so focused on a specific end, that the end is always part of it, but the process, it shifts day to day like water. You know what I mean? And so, we need nimble philanthropy that allows us to dream with the bag. You know what I mean? Not just you get the bag and this is exactly what you got to do, you know?
Richard, we've been asking all of our guests one question, and I'd love to pose it to you as well, which is, if you had a magic wand that you could wave and make possible immediately one major action item getting us closer to reparations, restitutions, et cetera, what would that be for you?
Every Black person in the United States has an opportunity to go home.
What do you mean by home?
To the continent of Africa. And on that trip, in that trip, they get reacclimated to the land. They get to understand the language. They learn what their last names would have been, could have been, should have been. And that serves for them as like this firm bedrock from which they can stand on, right? And know that they're not from this space, right? Nor are they of this space. And that, you know, I think, so that's my hope is that everyone could get, I mean, and there's so many different ideologies that, you know, that people have and they've used to kind of keep our people from wanting to visit the motherland and go home. And I think that so much of that could be broken by actually visiting and seeing the land for itself. It is beautiful. And to know that that's where you're from. I think it's so important for folks that don't have that, you know, that history to connect themselves to. And like Irish have it, right? The Italians have it. The French have it. And it sort of serves as like the core value system for them. And for Black folks, you have stripped us from that. And so at the end of the day, we think that we are what you've given us to be, right? What you provided for us to be. And in reality, we actually come from some of the richest soil, the richest people, right? I was in Benin and there was no police, right? What community was safety, conscious was safety, ancestors were safety, right? So you didn't violate trust because the ancestors were watching, not because the police were watching, right? And so for me, those core pieces that I think that our people would experience if they went home could dramatically change. Right. And that's not compensation. That's restitution.
There's something about having a cultural heritage that you can find grounding in that gives you a sense of pride in a white supremacist country. I know the feeling.
Right. And getting off a plane and being like, wait, so you're talking about for 100 miles this way, 100 miles that way, I won't see more than 10 white people. Like, you know what I mean? Like, and that's not to be shady, but that's just what it is. It's like, no, from here to here, this is all you. You don't feel like you're being watched or followed, you know, or any of those types of things. So for me, I just feel like it was very freeing for me. And I think the trip should be intentional.
And also going to a place where you're not a minority.
Yeah, powerful. When you're the majority, it's just like you get there, you're like, oh, crap, right? Like
it's a different feeling.
And it's full of contradictions as well. But just the experience alone, I feel like is transformational.
Give out a website where people can find out about the work you do and be inspired by it.
Yeah. So again, Richard Wallace, founder of Equity and Transformation, also known as EAT. You can find our work at www.eatchicago.org. We kind of go by EAT because we know everybody's got to eat, and that's who we focus on.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I've been speaking with Richard Wallace, founder and executive director of Equity and Transformation, or EAT, Chicago, during a recent conference on reparations in Atlanta, Georgia, produced for Yes Media, where I work as the racial justice editor. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. You can access this and other interviews on our website, risingupwithsonali.com, by becoming a subscriber. Find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify. And follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali.